picture of the mother and her two children whose bodies were found in their family home in South Dublin this week features on the front of a number of today's papers. The Irish Daily Star, Irish Daily Mirror, Irish Sun and Herald all lead with the deaths of Seema Banu and her two children, Asfira Syed and Faizan Syed. While the Irish Times reports in its front page this morning that the result of the postmortems are expected today. For its lead story, meanwhile, the Times reports that the HSE has confirmed that five nursing homes are receiving intensive support from the state as they battle serious outbreaks of coronavirus. This number is up from just one nursing home, which was receiving support a fortnight ago. Ban on baby clothes to stay. That's the lead headline in today's Irish Examiner. The paper quotes the Taoiseach saying that the government won't be lifting its ban on the sale of children's clothes and other household items in supermarkets because it's unfair on smaller retailers who have had to close because of the Level 5 restrictions. The Irish Independent leads today with the line that the reopening of schools after the midterm break was plunged into chaos yesterday after principals were instructed to remove 52 hand sanitizer products from use. Catherine Donnelly and Eilish O'Regan report that principals and boards of management will have to spend the weekend scrambling to secure fresh supplies ahead of Monday's return. The Irish Daily Mail leads today with the funerals of the three men who died in the apparent murder-suicide in Cork this week. The paper notes that the funeral service of Tadhg O'Sullivan and his youngest son Diarmaid, whose bodies were found together in a field on the family farm, are to take place in Castlemagner today, while the funeral of the eldest son of the family, Mark, whose body was found in his bedroom, is to be held tomorrow in Kanturk. Divided in life and in death is the headline there. The Irish News and Belfast Telegraph both lead with the resignation of Sinn Féin Senator Alicia McCallion, a story which also receives coverage on the front of today's Times and Examiner. All papers report that the senator and two party officials resigned after they failed to immediately return COVID-19 support grants, which collectively amounted to £30,000, which had been mistakenly paid to them. And there's more on this story by Philip Ryan and Cormac McQuinn inside today's Independent under the headline Rise and Fall of a Sinn Féin Star, how Alicia McCallion's career came to an abrupt end. Back in the front of the Examiner, it's reported there that the entire 6,000 strong membership of the IMO has agreed to back a decision by public health doctors to ballot on industrial action after a meeting with the Department of Health about consultancy contracts yesterday ended acrimoniously. The Star reports on its front page that former Meath GAA player Graham Geraghty is recovering after surgery in Beaumont Hospital in Dublin after he became ill at work earlier this week. And finally, as a reminder of the origins of Halloween, there's a picture on the back of today's Examiner of Julie Ní Whelan, described in the caption as the Dingle Druid, as she connects with the energy of Samhain at a ring fort on the Dingle Peninsula.
Well, what impact will the recall of more than 50 sanitising products have on schools reopening after the midterm on Monday? The Department of Education issued the recall notice last night. They say schools are safe and this is a precautionary measure. But opposition politicians say they have questions for the minister, and amongst them is the Social Democrats' education spokesman, Gary Gannon, who's on the line. Good morning, Gary Gannon.
Good morning, first of all,
just to clarify, you do back the schools reopening on Monday, do you?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's essential that we get our schools open for a variety of reasons. We don't have the childcare capacity in this country to make sure that we don't, but I think it's really important that schools open. I think we've seen during the close down the amount of kids with special education needs that fell behind. So yeah, it's absolutely important that we get it open. But that requires confidence, and it requires that school leaders, SNAs, teachers, have a sense of confidence that the department has their backs. And what we've discovered over the last couple of weeks and the last couple of months, Jordan, the various different ineffective procedures that have happened is that doesn't seem to be the case. And this latest call that came through at 6 o'clock yesterday that 52 sanitation products are not suitable for purpose, again, impacts confidence, erodes morale, and that leaves the school environment in a very negative place come Monday again.
But we are in the middle of a pandemic. Do you accept that the department, in reviewing all of the sanitising products that were being recommended to schools, that they have acted promptly after last week's recall of that one product?
I don't know if it's acted promptly. I mean, we're already like coming towards the end of midterm. These products were given out in September. We understood we were going to need sanitation products in schools, hand sanitizers, wipes. The fact that out of 150 allocated products, 52 of them now have been suggested. I don't want to say that they're in somewhat dangerous, but they're certainly not suitable for standards. So acting promptly is one of the things, but there was a serious breach or a fall down of protocol here, and we need to understand why that happened.
Do you fear that this is going to add to the calls for strike action over school safety by the ASTI, the teachers' union?
Yeah, I do. I really do. And this was an issue that I've been raising even since before schools reopened back in September. Their school morale is on the floor at the moment. Our school leaders, our teachers, SNAs feel like they've been abandoned. Every evening when you watch the news and you see the medical experts talk about social distancing, talk about the need to limit your interactions, all of that seems to operate, but that doesn't apply to schools. And that's impacting morale massively. So when the ASTI this week balloted for industrial action in relation to rapid testing and turnaround in relation to social distance capacity, low pay, I mean, that's a reflection of a multitude of different issues that are happening. And now we find out that the products that they've been asked to use were simply not suitable for purpose. It leaves us in a very precarious place in our schools.
Well, they did add 23 products to the list, didn't they, as well as removing 52, I think. You want the minister to come into the door next week, do you, and do a question and answer session on all of this?
I think it's absolutely, I think what we really need to see is leadership from the front. So I think the minister coming in, answering opposition questions, allaying fears by standing there confidently, outlining how this happened, how we can ensure that it doesn't happen again, talking about the type of investments, supports that we're going to give to our school leaders, and simply also just acknowledging the work that they've been doing. They've gone above and beyond the call of duty since the summer to get our schools back open. And just letting them, in their national chamber, letting that be relayed, I think is really, really important.
There's a lot of focus on sanitising products. Is there a risk maybe we're not looking at another key ingredient of keeping schools safe, and that's ventilation?
Yeah, I think that's when you can imagine the school environment at the minute. So in most classes, there's about 26 students, one teacher, and possibly one or two SNAs. Most of them don't have actual vent. Some classrooms don't have windows in them at the minute. So I mean, the capacity even for ventilation doesn't exist. Air school systems and air school buildings, many of them are antiquated and unsuitable for purpose outside of a pandemic. During the pandemic, that's been increased and magnified exponentially. So yeah, I think it's really important, but it comes down to the buildings that we've been teaching our students in for a long time, and that's just crystallised during the pandemic.
Although despite all of that, it's obviously worth bearing in mind the data that transmission in schools is lower than in the community. I want to ask you about one other thing, Gary Gannon. We play a little clip first. This was the exchange last night between Minister Damien English and Miriam O'Callaghan on Primetime, and it was about whether kids' clothing is an essential service. Here's a short clip of that exchange.
It's not confusing. I think we've had this discussion on numerous occasions with the retail sector. And to be clear, to try to make it fair, the difference now compared to last March is all those goods can still be purchased.
But Minister, are socks for your child essential?
Clothes are not essential. But again, there's still, of course, in all situations, there's a bit of common sense. And the Gardaí have been very...
That seems mad, Minister.
Well, again, what's essential, what's not essential, okay?
Clothes are not essential. Well, you can order them online and click and collect, can't you?
Some people can, but actually for a lot of parents, maybe not having the capacity for having an actual credit card or a Visa card, but then also some parents don't have any place where that can be delivered, or certainly won't be delivered in advance of Monday if they just need a couple of vests for their kids going back to schools. I think Minister English let himself down there with communication. I think the government needs to come out and rectify that now. We're in the midst of a pandemic. Appropriate and strong communication is really important to ensure that we get the appropriate type of buy-in from the community. So just come out and say, actually, you know what, children's clothes, vests, socks, whatever you need is actually essential, particularly
in advance
of schools
reopening. But where do you draw the line on that, Gary Gannon? Because, I mean, for instance, you know, there are lots of large supermarkets that would have a section that does kids' clothing, but what about other shops? How do you make that fair?
I think in terms of the large supermarkets that we're talking about, we know that actually in the first lockdown, you're walking around Tesco's, you can get your food items, but there's also an aisle there where you can pick up your socks and T-shirts. There's absolutely no point in closing those aisles at the minute. In terms of how we make it fair, we have to make it sensible. And I think closing down particular aisles in supermarkets where you could pick up your essential socks or your T-shirts, there's no point in closing them down. Do you have the capacity for ventilation? Do you can employ strong social distancing manners? That's not available in every shop at the moment, unfortunately. But for the large outlets who can, perhaps they should be able to.
Gary Gannon, Social Democrats education spokesman, thank you for talking to us on Morning Ireland. It's 19 minutes past seven.
The Court of Appeal yesterday ruled that a dead child cannot be identified when someone is charged with killing them. The ruling came in an appeal taken by RTE and other media outlets in a case of a woman who was found not guilty by reason of insanity of killing her three-year-old daughter. But is it likely to have far-reaching consequences for the way other court cases are covered by the media? Well, we can talk now to Michael O'Higgins, who's a senior counsel. Michael, good morning. Thanks for being with us.
Good morning, Tim.
Mr. Justice George Birmingham said yesterday that he appreciated that the media might find this ruling surprising, but he said that the statute was clear and unequivocal. I mean, can you explain why the media cannot identify a dead child when someone is charged with killing them?
I can. The Act provides that when proceedings involve a child, you cannot publish any information that would lead to the identification of that child. So if, for example, you said that someone had been killed or even assaulted by their father or their uncle, the reference to the father or uncle, if the father or uncle was named, would indirectly identify the child. But what was unusual about the Court of Appeal decision is that it said that child in those circumstances constituted a child who was deceased. So in a situation where it's a homicide case, if it's a father or a relative, or if it was somebody who was so closely connected to the child, that to name them would effectively lift the veil on the identification of the child, that falls foul of the Act and would be a criminal offence.
And normally the law is there to protect people, and in this case it would be there to protect children. But when a child is dead, isn't it unusual that, you know, you would still be trying to protect an interest where there is no, you know, there is no actual interest to protect? But the court found that wasn't the case. The law was still very clear, as you say.
Well, I think that's very fair observation. I mean, the Act itself is designed to protect the interests of children who are vulnerable. But as was pointed out in one of the arguments put before the court, that level of protection doesn't arise if the person is deceased. In fairness to the court, wasn't, as it were, trying to overextend on the Act. It just took the view that the manner in which the Act was drafted didn't provide for this situation, and the proper way to provide for it was for the Oireachtas to bring amending legislation if that is what was deemed desirable, but they weren't in a position to fill the gap. That's the view they took on the argument. I think most people would be surprised they took that view. And they did say themselves it would lead to surprising results. But that's the view they took.
And the implications then arising out of a case like this would mean, for example, that if you had the family of a dead child who wanted to speak about their son or their daughter after somebody had been convicted of their murder, that the media would have great difficulty in reporting those words, wouldn't
it? That seems to be so, and Colm Keane in the Irish Times has written about this morning, pointing out that in the recent Kriegel case, so much of the coverage just would not be permitted. It also actually has much further, far-rising implications, because the court itself added that it wasn't confined only to instances where someone was deceased, but it also said it couldn't exclude proceedings relating to offences committed against a child as a child if they come on for hearing after the child has become an adult. So child sexual abuse cases, if at the conclusion, if a person was convicted and that person was a relative and wanted to waive their anonymity, under the judgment it would appear that anybody who published the child's name, linking it to, or published the child's name in those circumstances, would be committing an offence. So it has very far-reaching implications.
The court, as you mentioned, seemed to kick it to the Oireachtas to deal with this. Is that the only way it can be dealt with?
Well, so that or if one of the parties is granted an appeal to the Supreme Court, the Supreme Court will take a fresh look at it, but unless they reach a different conclusion, very much so the only remedy is for the Oireachtas to bring in amending legislation.
All right. Michael O'Higgins, Senior Counsel, thank you very much indeed for that. It's 24 minutes past seven.
And we go to France now, where details are emerging about the young man who's believed to have been the attacker on that attack in the Basilica in Nice yesterday, which left three people dead. Anne-Elisabeth Moutet, the Telegraph columnist, is in Paris and joins us from there. Anne-Elisabeth, what are we learning about the man who's believed to have been the assailant in Nice?
Good morning, Olia. What we know, he's a 22-year-old Tunisian who arrived in France perhaps only 12 hours ago, before 12 hours before the murder itself. He had come to Europe via the island of Lampedusa in Italy, where lots of migrants have been gathered. And he came through the Nice station from Italy. Nice is very close to Italy, and acquired or showed to security cameras. It was obvious that he had a large knife. At 8:29, he went into the church. He first killed a 60-year-old woman who was praying, and then he killed the church warden. He decapitated the first woman, and he attacked a third woman, 44 years old, attacking her with multiple blows with a knife, and she managed to escape outside, which is how people seeing this woman covered in blood realized that the police had to be called almost immediately. And she fled to a cafe, but she died there of her wounds. And meanwhile, the police had arrived, tried to stop him. He then drew out another weapon. They shot him, and he's now in hospital between life and death.
And of course, there were other knife attacks yesterday. This is the third such attack in a month. What's the tension now in France over the right to blaspheme?
The tension in France is that people are attacking us. The right to blaspheme is not something that's being questioned by anyone, including the extreme left, who have been very vocal in the fact that the necessary war against terrorism should not include war against Muslims. And I think that's a consensus for everyone except the extreme right, actually. But the tension is that we are being attacked for something that now is seen so normal than even the U.S. A man at the U.N., a Spanish functionary of the U.N., has just said that everybody should respect everyone else, as if from the time of the Satanic Verses, when Salman Rushdie wrote his book 25 years ago, to this day, outside France, it seems acceptable to kill people because you've drawn a cartoon.
Anne-Elisabeth Moutet, Telegraph columnist in Paris. Thank you very much indeed for speaking to us on Morning Ireland. It's 27 minutes past seven.
Amazon continues to be one of the biggest winners from the pandemic. Sales at the internet giant shot to over $96 billion in the 3 months to the end of September, up 37% from the same period in 2019. Facebook reported a whopping 2.5 billion daily users on average in September across its platforms. Revenue at Facebook jumped 22%. Twitter reported 187 million daily active users between July and September. Its revenue rose 14%. At Google, revenue was up 14%. The rise helped profits jump an eye-popping 59% year-on-year to more than $11 billion. Apple sales hit $64.7 billion, up slightly from a year ago. But shares in the firm sank in after-hours trading as investors digested a more than 20% drop in iPhone revenue. In a third quarter trading statement, AIB says 74% of borrowers who availed of payment breaks granted in retail banking have returned to regular payments. On the currencies, €1 buys 90.4 pence sterling and $1 16.7 cents.
Heck of a weekend in sport. Six Nations, of course, coming up. We're going to be looking ahead to that later. And also, this weekend sees the start of the Men's and Ladies Gaelic Football Championships. That's all coming up in the next hour. But we begin with Dundalk's trip to London last night. No joy for them in their Europa League tie at Arsenal. They eventually lost 3-0 at the Emirates Stadium. They played well and was scoreless after 40 minutes. And then two bad defensive errors just before the break allowed Arsenal get two goals inside a minute. And they led 2-0 at half time. Nicolas Pepe scored just after the restart, making it 3-0. That was the final score. And it's tough in Dundalk because they're back in action against St Pat's in Inchicore on Sunday in the league, and then away to Rapid Vienna in the third match in the group next Thursday. Also in their group last night, Molde of Norway beat Rapid Vienna 1-0, so the Norwegians join Arsenal at the top of the table on 6 points apiece. The Arsenal manager, Mikel Arteta, was relieved with the Dundalk victory.
Well, I didn't know how they were going to play, whether to play. They've been playing 4-3-3 all season, 4-1-4-1. And I knew they could come back after what they've seen the last few weeks and play with five at the back. We were prepared for that. But then a really committed team again, the way they go about every ball. And they try hard, credit to them for what they've done in the last few months. And yeah, happy to beat them.
Elsewhere, Celtic lost a two-goal lead, but they did hold out for a 2-2 draw away to the French league leaders Lille. Rangers beat Lech Poznan 1-0. Spurs, disappointing loss 1-0 to Royal Antwerp. The manager, Jose Mourinho, not happy with the players afterwards, although he said, blame me. And Leicester were 2-1 winners at AEK Athens. Now, interesting story in domestic soccer, where Galway United have been handed a reprieve following an appeal over a points deduction involving Wexford FC in the Electricity League First Division. Wexford appealed a points deduction over them playing an illegal player. They took the FAI's Appeal Commission decision to an arbitration, which found in favour of Wexford. And that changes the final standings of the First Division. Cabinteely now lose the points they had received, so they drop out of the playoffs and Galway move inside the top five. And they're now due to play Bray Wanderers tomorrow in the first leg of the semi-final playoffs. But Cabinteely may seek to delay that playoff. In cycling, Tour de France green jersey winner Sam Bennett has been stripped of a second stage win at the Tour of Spain after he was found guilty of irregular sprinting. Bennett thought he'd sealed his ninth Grand Tour stage win and a second in this year's Vuelta, but Belgian Pascal Ackermann was subsequently awarded the stage after the commissar studied footage of Bennett hitting Emil Liepens with his shoulder heading on the run to the stage finish, and Bennett was then relegated to last place. Dan Martin still going well, he remains in third place overall. In rugby, Connacht's Pro 14 clash with Benetton on Sunday has been postponed after some members of the Italians panel tested positive for COVID-19. Meanwhile, France have named Gael Ficou on the wing for tomorrow night's big Six Nations clash with Ireland and Paris. Remember, if Ireland win, we can win the Six Nations. The Stade France, a player, moves from inside centre to the left wing, taking the place of the injury Teddy Thomas. And centre Arthur Vincent slots in at 12 in the only change in personnel from their win over Wales. We'll be looking ahead to that game later with Donal Lennon. And as I said, it's also a weekend that sees the start of the men's and women's Gaelic football championships, those previews coming up at 8:30. But in hurling, what a weekend. On the 100th birthday of Christy Ring, we've provincial semi-finals in Leinster and Munster, and to get his verdict on them, we've another Cloyne man, Donal O'Cusick. And we're going to start with Leinster, and first up, it's Kilkenny versus Dublin.
Good morning, Des. Dublin put in a good performance last week, racking up an impressive 231 in the process, albeit against what must be said an unimpressive Laois. Kilkenny are like all teams at the moment that are first day out. We've no form really to go by, but they have been operating at a higher level to Dublin over the last few years and expect this to continue tomorrow in Croke Park.
All right then, and it's followed by Galway against Wexford.
Again, little to no form to go off here. Galway were All-Ireland champions only 3 seasons ago and went close 2 seasons ago. Wexford could have been champions last season. Like a lot, this will come down to who's managed the pandemic best, and I know Davey doesn't do not being prepared. He's probably one of the few people on the planet who had a playbook ready in case of such an event. Given that, and the fact that Wexford are further down the road than Shane O'Neill could be with Galway during his first year in charge, I'll go for Wexford, Des.
All right, you're making it intriguing already. And we move on then to the two Munster semi-finals, equally tight, Cork against Waterford.
Cork have injuries to Dara Fitzgibbon and Owen Cadigan, and Robbie Flynn is suspended. Waterford announced their team late last night and have named their marquee player Austin Gleeson at wing-back, but it wouldn't surprise me to see him deployed much further upfield. They have a new manager in Liam Cahill who's got a good record against Cork at underage level. This Cork team, while unfair to generalise, isn't noted for high work rate, and the numbers over the last few years support that statement. Liam Cahill's teams generally are. If Cork aren't ready for that, then they'll be in trouble. However, Des, the game is on in Thurles, which Cork will almost consider a home venue, and maybe my heart is ruling my head when I give Cork a tentative vote.
OK, and then we have Limerick against Tip, the big one.
the big one, champions against would-be champions. What a prospect. I'm doing this game in Páirc Uí Chaoimh on Sunday and really looking forward to it. We're looking at two serious contenders for the title here. How have Tip managed during the shutdown, Des? Who knows? We know how Limerick have. We also know Limerick have gotten rid of any cobwebs during the first half against Clare last Sunday. Limerick don't do goals like Tip do. Tip will need goals in their attack to win this. Limerick appear at their most vulnerable in their full back line, so that aspect of the game makes for intriguing viewing. Having said all that, I'm going for Limerick based on their overall game and them to march on to the Munster final come Sunday evening.
All right, thanks for that, Don Logan. Of course, extensive coverage on RT on all platforms over the weekend. Saturday Sport and Radio 1 tomorrow goes from 2 o'clock to 10 o'clock. Now, the Camogie fixtures this weekend see Cork host Wexford, and the big clash really is Clare hosting Dublin, because the winners of that game will advance to the quarter final. And Dublin's interim manager Dave Dunning is gung-ho about their prospects.
Oh, it's going to be a dogger down there, you know, especially Clare at home. Over the years, it's been tight between Dublin and Clare, and this is going to be no different. And it's going to be a dogfight, but we've great confidence in ourselves. We're going to go down and we're going to give it a lash, and we're going to attack them, and we're going to come out the winners. That's it.
Meanwhile, in golf at the Bermuda Championships, Padraig Harrington is currently tied for 6th place on 4 under par after a round of 67. He's 4 strokes behind the leader, Peter Malnati of the US. Waterford's Seamus Power finished on 2 over. And finally for now, a reminder, we have 2 race meetings today at Down Royal this afternoon and the evening meeting at Dundalk.
And a treat for you too, fans, now. The album, All That You Can't Leave Behind, is 20 years old today. It's the album Bono said brought U2 back to scratch to reapply for the job of the best band in the world. The album was recorded in Dublin in France. It won 7 Grammy Awards, and Cian McCormack has this anniversary report.
All That You Can't Leave Behind, the 10th studio album by U2. An album Bono famously said this about at the Grammys in 2001.
Going back to scratch, reapplying for the job. What job? The best band in the world job. Thank you.
The album celebrates 20 years today. It has sold over 12 million copies and includes the songs Beautiful Day, Walk On, Elevation and Stuck in a Moment You Can't Get Out Of. Toronto-based producer Daniel Lanois co-produced the album with Brian Eno.
We made that in the studio by the canal. It's a good snapshot of what people were going through at that time. And if the
darkness is to keep. One standout memory for Lanois is how Beautiful Day was shaped and recorded.
After batting the song around for a few days, Eno and I came in and built this little, more little beatbox approach. You know, it had this little, just like. And so suddenly had a little more roller coaster in it. And this was a great time for a great moment for Larry, because Larry likes to play at a metronomic time. So by providing this little beat to him, he was able to come up with something very different for himself.
RTE DJ Dave Fanning says the album is a testament to the band going back to basics.
The album does stand the test of time. I mean, the thing is, you've got to understand what they had just done in the 90s. Well, they started off with Octone Baby, which was huge, and then they went into Zaropa, and then they went really weird with the Passengers album. That was the one with Pavarotti on it. And then they went completely crazy with all the irony and the Las Vegas and the epic bombast and the enormous domes and the giant fruit and coming out of lemons and all the rest of it, etc. And they, if you like, I mean, supposedly, this was all about the deconstruction of the rock and roll band format to its absolutely nth degree. So where do you go from here? You go slightly backwards. Not that they went totally backwards. There was plenty of evidence of 90s experimentalism on this album, but it was basically guitar, bass, drums, vocals and great songs. That's really what it was. Also very personal.
And the personal nature of this album sets it apart from others, according to Dave Fanning.
The song's obviously huge. The second song, Stuck in a Moment You Can't Get Out of, very personal, all about his friend Michael Hutchins, who had died 3 or 4 years beforehand.
I'm not afraid of anything in this world.
Also, there's a song called Kite, which really is about Bono being both a son and a father. And his father was dying while this album was being made. And then when they played at Slane, he had died that week. And it was a really big scene in terms of just how personal the album was, how thoughtful and how tender a lot of the songs are.
You've got to get yourself together.
Is it worth celebrating after 20 years then?
You know, it's always worth celebrating stuff from the past if it's really very good. And All That You Can't Leave Behind is really very good.
A treat for you two fans there. Cian McCormack reporting. It's 7:45.
Now, from cyberbullying to selfies, from fake news to social distancing, modern English and Irish is changing. And with those changes comes a new dictionary, the first major English-Irish dictionary in over 60 years, will be officially launched by President Michael D. Higgins later today. It will feature new words like Brexit, Home Office and the aforementioned social distancing. To tell us more is Padraig O'Manine, chief editor of the new concise English-Irish dictionary. Padraig, good morning.
Good morning.
60 years is a long time to wait for an updated dictionary. How difficult will this dictionary be from the last one?
Well, obviously, you know, any dictionary really is meant to reflect life as it is when the dictionary is published. And, you know, the last dictionary, which came out in 59, didn't even contain the word computer. So, this new dictionary, not alone does it cover modern English, as spoken in Ireland currently, but also modern Irish as spoken. And as well as that, it reflects modern dictionaries, in as much as older dictionaries would have been more formal, would have been more maybe conservative in what they covered, whereas all modern dictionaries now are much more democratic. They reflect language as spoken and covers both informal and formal language. So it's very different to what was there before.
And who decides what the appropriate translation is for a particular word? I mean, you take a word like selfie, which I think is feigning in the new dictionary that you have. Who signs off on a translation?
Well, there is a national terminology committee as well, and we would have been collaborating with them on a lot of terminology, one word terminologies. It would have been more of a challenge for us to try and translate a lot of the informal or common usage English words, because there's such a gap to the last dictionary, we couldn't just take the last one and just add words to it. So we had to really rely on our translators and people from the various dialects. Obviously, we have three main dialects in Irish, and we tried as best as we could to cover the main dialects. So we really relied on the instinctive translations of our translating team to get most of the informal words in.
And how difficult then was it to get the new coronavirus words in? You have words there like social distancing, I suppose banana bread, it's very important these days, and the Home Office. They all came into play very late in the day.
Well, the dictionary was meant to go to print around about March, and obviously with the pandemic hitting us at such short notice, we got 24 hours notice to close the offices. But in a way, that gave us the extra couple of weeks it took us to adapt to those circumstances, and the fact that the team were scattered as opposed to being on the one location, that gave us a chance to add in, you know, words such as coronavirus or social distancing. And really, any printed dictionary is dated by the latest terms that they contain. So at least we can now say that up to around about April or May of this year, this dictionary is up to date. But unfortunately, every book goes out of date the day it's printed. So it'll be a while before we get, you know, even more current terminology in.
And that is not Breag Nuacht, which is fake news. Padraig O'Manine, chief editor of the new Concise English-Irish Dictionary. Thanks for joining us.
Morning, Ireland. It's 9 minutes to 8 and Petula Martin has the business news.
Thanks, Anya. Let me paint you a picture of a business set up by artist and entrepreneur Aisling Burke in Galway in 2015 called Paint Club. Paint Club is a creative social event where people who might never have touched a paintbrush in their lives spend an evening with friends and leave with their very own masterpiece. When the pandemic hit, venues which hosted Paint Club across the country closed their doors. To survive, Aisling pivoted her business online.
You join us via Facebook. So we decided on the Facebook platform to host our tutorials, I suppose you could call them. And they are live tutorials. So they're not pre-recorded. It is our artists live in their studios slash kitchens because we were all locked down. And if you needed to, we began selling starter packs as well. And then you would have everything that we have to create your paintings at home and just kind of get a little bit of the Paint Club experience at home safely. So that was the idea. So the four colours I have out are white, yellow, like a primary yellow, magenta, which is a pink, and then your cerulean or cyan blue.
Paint Club is a business, and it was important to Aisling that people continued to pay for tutorials.
I have been in the art industry now my whole life. So I have a degree in fine art from Limerick School of Art and Design. I have been teaching for, I think I'm teaching now 13, 14 years in the adult education sector. And the one thing that I find all the time in the arts and the creative industries is that there is this tendency to people don't value your work and to do stuff for free or for exposure or to put it on YouTube and things like that. So from the beginning, I refused to give what is necessarily our talents and our services for free. So we put it like in any other normal business. You know, if you want access to what we give you or service, you do need to pay.
The move online has proven successful. Aisling and her team of artists celebrated their 100th Paint Club live event this week.
Tiny little bits. We're going to take our time with it and build it up gently. So down in there with the salmon colour.
Do you think post-pandemic, whenever post-pandemic will be, that you'll continue to do Paint Club online as well as in venues?
Yes, 100%. So we've proven that it's worked. We're reaching customers in Europe and in America and in Australia, Dubai. Because it's online, we're getting an awful lot of expats and people are telling their friends and relations about us. And then they're joining in together. They might be countries apart, but they're joining in together and having a shared experience that way as well. We love it. This is what we do. Even if we didn't have an audience, we'd still be painting, but it's so much more fun with people.
Aisling Burke, founder of Paint Club. Elsewhere, the latest sales and profit figures from America's big tech companies exceed Wall Street expectations. I'll have the details at 8:30. For now, back to you, Justin.
Now, are we in for a trick or a treat with the weather this Halloween weekend? Let's find out now from Matthew Martin at Met Erin.
Thanks, Justin, and a very good morning here from Met Erin. Well, we will see a brief improvement in weather conditions today with lots of dry weather once the morning rain and drizzle clears. Unfortunately, though, very unsettled weather will return for the weekend with a weather advisory in operation nationwide and also a status yellow wind warning in operation for tomorrow, Saturday, Halloween. And this warning will be reviewed this morning and it could well be upgraded to a more severe level. So please do keep a close eye on the forecast today and check our warnings, which are updated frequently. At present, though, it is rather cloudy and damp, and there is patchy outbreaks of light rain and drizzle. But drier and brighter conditions will extend from the west through this morning, and then it will leave a mostly dry afternoon and evening, with bright spells and just a few isolated showers. Top temperatures for today will range from 10 to 13 degrees in moderate west or southwest winds. Then tonight will start mostly dry, but a deepening depression is going to approach from the south, with rain extending north over the country, accompanied by strengthening southeasterly winds. Gales and strong gales will develop at the coast by Saturday morning, and these gales even extending inland at times, bringing some severe and damaging wind gusts, with a risk of some disruption. Then tomorrow, Saturday, then will begin extremely windy with widespread squally showers or longer spells of rain. And there will be further severe and possibly damaging gusts extending northwards across the country. Also combined with some very high seas at our coasts. It will stay very windy then for tomorrow afternoon with a mix of dry spells and squally showers, some with hail and thunder. The winds though will begin to abate tomorrow evening, and tomorrow evening will turn mostly dry across the country. Top temperatures for tomorrow ranging 12 to 15 degrees, but these will occur early on with it turning colder as the day progresses. Further wet and windy weather then for a Saturday night, with heavy falls of rain extending northwards later in the night with some spot flooding. Drier weather for a time though on Sunday, but unfortunately another spell of heavy rain looks set to extend nationwide for the afternoon and evening. But to recap, very unsettled this weekend, potentially turning stormy tomorrow with wind warnings in operation, and these may be upgraded to a more severe warning level this morning, so do please keep a close eye on the forecast today. That's all from Mid Erin for now. Thanks for listening and take care.
It's 8 o'clock on Friday, the 30th of October. You're listening to Morning Ireland with Justin McCarthy and Áine Lawler. News now from Ciarán Éverin.
The Commission of Investigation into Mother and Baby Homes will submit its final report today after 5 years of work. The report, which is more than 4,000 pages long, will not be published until it's reviewed by the Minister for Children, the Attorney General and government departments. The Taoiseach has said the intention is to publish as soon as possible. The report will include the testimonies of people who lived and worked in 14 mother and baby homes and 4 county homes between the 1920s and 1990s. On Wednesday night, the government clarified that adoptees and survivors of mother and baby homes are legally entitled to access their personal data. The Social Democrats' education spokesman Gary Gannon has said the Minister for Education, Norma Foley, should answer questions in the Dáil to allay fears people may have following the latest recall of sanitisation products in schools. Deputy Gannon said he fully backed the reopening of schools next Monday, but there needed to be leadership from the front. On this programme, the Dublin Central TD said there were also issues relating to ventilation in some school buildings and called for the government to classify children's clothes as essential items in retail outlets remaining open under Level 5 restrictions.
I think the government needs to come out and rectify that now. We're in the midst of a pandemic. Appropriate and strong communication is really important to ensure that we get the appropriate type of buy-in from the community. So just come out and say, actually, you know what, children's clothes, vests, socks, whatever you need is actually essential.
French officials have been setting out the movements of the Tunisian man suspected of carrying out the knife attack in Nice yesterday, in which 3 people were killed. They say he arrived in the city by train and changed his clothes and shoes before walking to the nearby Notre Dame church. The 21-year-old, who was shot by police after the attack, was carrying 3 knives, 2 phones and a Quran. France's chief anti-terrorist prosecutor, Jean-François Ricard, gave details of the man's condition.
As for the assailant, he was taken to hospital to be operated on. He is very seriously wounded. He's still in a life-threatening condition. When he was arrested, he was carrying a document from the Italian Red Cross in the name of a Tunisian national born in 1999. Initial investigations have shown that this identity is that of the assailant.
A new €20 million fund to enhance disability services, many of which have recently been reopening following COVID closures, will be announced today. Grants will be made available for extra therapy sessions, training and upgrading buildings. This is in addition to the disability funding announced in Budget 2021. Mary Regan of our political staff.
Last January, just weeks before the general election, a 1% cut to the disability budget was announced. This left many services, including daycare and respite settings, with their futures in doubt. Weeks in office and just as COVID restrictions left many of these services closed, the Taoiseach announced that that cut would be reversed. Today, the Health Minister, Stephen Donnelly, will announce that a further €20 million will be made available for grants to services which have been reopening. Voluntary organisations will be able to apply for grants to ensure that they can remain sustainable into the future, including for measures to improve governance and to enhance backroom support such as IT and payroll. Grants will also be made available for additional therapy sessions for service users, as well as small building works to make care settings more homelike and technology that might help to enhance independence.
The number of cases of COVID-19 in Ireland since the start of the pandemic has risen to more than 60,000. The 14-day incidence rate per 100,000 of the population has fallen for a third day in a row to just over 292. As of yesterday afternoon, 328 COVID-19 patients were in hospital, of which 43 were in intensive care units. 866 new confirmed cases were announced yesterday evening. There were a further six deaths. The funerals of a father and his two sons who died in a shooting on a farm in North Cork earlier this week will take place today and tomorrow. Gardaí are investigating the deaths as a suspected murder-suicide. The funerals of 59-year-old Tig O'Sullivan, his 23-year-old son Dermot O'Sullivan, will take place at St Mary's Church in Castlemagner, with burial afterwards in St Bridget's Cemetery. A private funeral will be held for 26-year-old Mark O'Sullivan tomorrow afternoon at the Church of the Immaculate Conception in Kanturk. And now the weather.
RTÉ Radio 1 weather with Ulster Bank. Thinking of switching your mortgage? The Ulster Bank mortgage team are available to talk. Hail, rain or shine.
Rain and drizzle clearing eastwards during this morning to leave a largely dry day with bright spells and just isolated showers. Highest temperatures 10 to 13 degrees. And there's a warning that south or southeast winds will increase to gale force or strong gale force later tonight and tomorrow on all Irish coastal waters and on the Irish Sea.
The two family tragedies which dominated the news all week continue to receive coverage on today's front pages. The Irish Daily Star, Irish Daily Mirror, Irish Sun and Herald all lead today with the deaths of Seema Banu and her two children, Asfira Syed and Faizan Syed, whose bodies were found in their family home in South Dublin this week. The Irish Times reports on its front page, meanwhile, that the result of the postmortems are expected later today. The Irish Daily Mail leads today, meanwhile, with the funerals of the three men who died in the apparent murder-suicide in Cork this week. The paper notes that the funeral service of Tig O'Sullivan and his youngest son, Dermot, whose bodies were found together in a field on the family farm, are to take place in Castlemagner today, while the funeral of the eldest son of the family, Mark, whose body was found in his bedroom, is to be held tomorrow in Kanturk. Divided in life and in death is the headline there. For its lead story, The Times reports that the HSE has confirmed that five nursing homes are receiving intensive support from the state, up from one a fortnight ago, as they battle serious outbreaks of coronavirus. The Irish Examiner leads with comments made by the Taoiseach, in which he said that the government won't be lifting its ban on the sale of children's clothes and other household items in supermarkets, since it's unfair on smaller retailers who've had to close. The Irish Independent leads with the line that the reopening of schools after the midterm break was plunged into chaos yesterday after principals were instructed to remove 52 hand sanitizer products from use. The Irish News and Belfast Telegraph both lead with the resignation of Sinn Féin Senator Alicia McCallion, a story which is also covered on the front of today's Times and Examiner. All papers report that the senator and two party officials resigned after they failed to immediately return COVID-19 support grants amounting to £30,000 in total, which had been mistakenly paid to them. The Star reports on its front page that former Meath GAA player Graham Geraghty is recovering after he underwent surgery this week in Beaumont Hospital. Elsewhere this morning, the number of people needing kidney dialysis has increased dramatically this year due to a reduction in transplants and increased numbers in intensive care. That's in today's Times, as is a story about a report produced for the Department of Agriculture, which has found that forestry in this country is a growing source of carbon emissions. There's a piece in today's Examiner about how Forsa, the trade union representing ushers in Leinster House, has expressed concern over their safety, stating that the Oireachtas is acting as if there was no pandemic. And finally, back in today's Times, there's a report there on the demolition of Hawkins House in Dublin. Olivia Kelly reports that the same firm that demolished Apollo House in 2017 has begun an 11-month programme to level one of the city's least popular buildings.
Now, winter is a challenging time for the health service in normal times, but this winter, with COVID-19 still spreading, health workers will proceed with trepidation and uncertainty into the coming months. Yesterday, the HSE Chief Executive Paul Reid spoke of some positive indicators in the way the virus is progressing here, but he also said that he was very apprehensive about the winter ahead. Well, Paul Reid is on the line now. Good morning and thank you for being with us.
Good morning, Justin.
Latest figures last evening show that there are now 330 confirmed cases of COVID-19 in hospitals. Of these, 43 are in intensive care units. Are those numbers manageable at the moment?
Yeah, well, we have seen a steady trend increase in both hospitalisations and the ICU over the past number of weeks. We are still managing. We are apprehensive, as I said yesterday, just looking forward. And that really is around a few issues. Firstly, there are some positive trends, and your listeners should take encouragement from them in terms of reduced cases, reduced positivity and reduced contacts. But what we are watching out for is a kind of what I describe as a multi-lag effect. So increased numbers of cases in younger people, 19 and 24, that then progressing into increasing cases in the 65 age plus, which were more vulnerable, that then meaning more hospitalizations over the coming weeks, potentially more ICU, and ultimately what we all want to protect is more deaths. So it's more to look forward that are apprehensive about. Now, just again, to reassure your listeners, we do have a very significant 600 million winter plan investment, which we're implementing at the moment to protect everybody.
Okay, and just looking at that lag effect that you speak of, that's where you have at the moment a lot of younger people who are infected with the virus. They may spread the virus to older people, and that's when the problems really will hit the health service. When do you expect that this virus will hit its peak in terms of hospital numbers and ICU cases over the winter?
Well, it's difficult at the moment to predict, but what we need to be cautious of is exactly what's happening in Europe. If you look at France, Spain, Italy, Belgium, and they are seeing those trends of the rising cases and then more hospitalizations, more infection rates in older people. So it's really as we look forward. I think if we can sustain the progress that we've made over the last week, manage to hold and turn the trend over the coming weeks, that gives us very significant protections throughout the winter, you know.
But are you planning for a particular point in the winter where you think things are going to hit their peak and be quite challenging for the hospitals and the ICU departments?
No, well, the modelling that was being done for an effort and well presented over the last couple of weeks did set out, you know, if we continued on the trend that we were at, the numbers of cases that we would see rising through November and towards the end of November would have put us at huge risk. But positively, what has happened over the past, well, we've probably some early effect from, a later effect from the level 3 measures, and now what's happened over the past week, we are seeing that curve beginning to hold, and hopefully what everything we're doing can bring that down forward, and we don't see those predicted volumes.
Okay, now the last time, I suppose, in the first wave of this virus, the virus really hit in nursing homes. I know that you are providing, or the HSE is providing, intensive support to 5 nursing homes at the moment. Are you expecting, or are you prepared to provide support for others?
Yeah, well, overall, we're looking at, I mean, there's about 1,100 long-term residential care facilities for all the people that we would be, you know, supporting overall that we'd watch. Ultimately, in terms of nursing homes, obviously, it's a high risk. There are about 20 to 25 that we would be giving a range of supports to. It's probably 4 who would be on higher risk at the moment in terms of a wider range of supports that we would be given to, and that would range from infection prevention control measures, multidisciplinary teams supporting as appropriate, arranging clinical care through GP, and in a very small number of cases where we may have to put in staff directly or support further allocation of staff. But thankfully, they have the supports we've been working with those nursing homes have stabilised matters over the last week and few days, and that's what we want to continue.
Okay, now you spoke yesterday about a reassuring picture for schools with lower transmission rates in schools than there are in the community. But we know that some schools are struggling to get teachers and indeed students back because they may be self-isolating. What the teachers are asking for is rapid testing. Is that going to happen for them? Is rapid testing or is antigen testing going to be provided for schools?
Well, if you just stand back for the schools thing and specifically answer the question on rapid testing, on schools overall, what we have, and we set out yesterday, if you take the positivity rates of contacts in schools, it's running at about 2.5% overall. It's lower, actually, in the post-primary. It's about 2%, and it's about 2.7% in primary. a small number of schools where we do see contagion spread. It's a marginal number, I think about 70 schools overall where you would see further spread. And in those cases, it's probably on average about 3 students or combination students and teachers. So very low transmission levels. And that has held with the, if you just take, for example, the positivity rate of younger children before school was about 14% of our total cases. After when schools returned, it's about 15%. In terms of rapid testing, we do turn our tests around very quickly and we prioritise. The PCR test is the most reliable test at this point in time for everybody. Should antigen tests emerge, and we're evaluating them right now, and I do hope they emerge soon for certain purposes. But the PCR is the most reliable and most reliable one for schools at the moment.
You're expressing hope that the antigen test may emerge soon, but the teachers say they need it immediately, or they need it in the coming school term. Is that likely, do you think?
Well, antigen testing is going to take more time in terms of evaluation. But
How much more time do you think?
It's a process that's ongoing. It has been led through an effort in HICWA. We're contributing now in terms of the validation. But I think what the teachers have been urging, and we've been working very closely with them over the past week, and indeed school principals and Department of Education, is a wide range of supports. The test is our turnaround. We had one of our consultants of public health yesterday, Dr. Abby Collins, outlining the wide range of assessments that goes in with schools. Tests are looked at on batch,
yes,
and a wide range of assessments.
But I want just to bring you specifically back to antigen testing, or these rapid tests. I mean, should teachers and teacher unions, should they have an expectation that they're going to get those rapid tests between now and Christmas?
Well, I mean, that's an assessment that's going out on a wider perspective, not just in terms of schools. My sense and my judgment would be the PCR test is the most reliable test, and particularly for schools at this point in time. It is about turning the whole process around quickly, and that's what we've been working with over the past week with schools. And you know, I think it's more about what has happened this week and how we've worked with our schools again. The risks in schools in terms of transmission are much lower than they are in the general public in terms of contacts.
If they are lower than the general community, then, I mean, is it right to be prioritising schools for the fast turnaround of testing? Should you not be moving your focus, or shifting your focus to the community and away from schools if the transmission rate in schools is lower than it is in the community?
Well, look, I think the priority for all of us, including the HSE, has been to keep our schools open. We know the impact of not having children in school. We've done a paediatric support of it, and it's quite significant. And the risks of not having children in school are significant. So we all want to do that. What we have done at HSE, though, however, we've carried out serial testing in nursing homes still. We're still carrying out serial testing in meat plants. We've carried out testing in direct provision centres and other vulnerable locations. And we will do that as well as the general population.
All right. I'm sure you're keeping a close eye on the situation in Northern Ireland, which continues to be problematic. Have you had any requests yet from the Northern Ireland Health Service for assistance in treating COVID patients in the Republic of Ireland?
Yeah, at an operating level, we would have various levels of engagement with the North of Ireland. First of all, in the hospital level. Secondly, our lead ICU consultant for clinical care, Michael Power, would have they have a kind of shared group, which is called the North-South Critical Care Collaboration Group. And they would have been engaged over the past couple of weeks in particular, and in regular engagement throughout this week. There has not been a formal request for help in terms of ICU or other beds, but should that emerge, or should that request be made, our teams are working very closely and would be very willing to support.
If that were to come, Paul Reid, would that have an impact then on other non-COVID services here?
Well, look, obviously we have to manage all of the risks. What we have managed so far to date in the Republic of Ireland is to keep the COVID care going and keep our non-COVID care services, including elective care. Now, some hospitals have had to turn the dial back on elective care that have gone into surge, but not many of our hospitals. But that's a whole set of risk crosses we would have to work through. But at this stage, we haven't had a request. And in the north, they are, in some cases, using their surge capacity, but not all yet.
All right. Paul Reid, Chief Executive of the Health Service Executive. Thank you for joining us on Morning Ireland. The time is 22 minutes past 8.
Now, the Commission of Investigation into Mother and Baby Homes submits its final report today after 5 years of work. The report is more than 4,000 pages long. It won't be published until it's been reviewed by Children's Minister Roderick O'Gorman, the Attorney General and government departments. The Taoiseach has said the intention is to publish the report as soon as possible. It includes the testimonies of people who lived and worked in 14 mother and baby homes and 4 county homes between the 1920s and the 1990s. The Commission itself dissolves at the end of February next year. Our religious and social affairs correspondent, Alva Keneally, has this report on how it all began.
We care about the children here on these grounds, and we want to show them that we care. So we came here in numbers to show them.
It's something that happened in the area that shouldn't have happened, and it brought a lot of sadness to the area.
It's a legacy which has cast a shadow over the Irish state for decades.
We need to go right across and give them all the same.
A local historian, Catherine Corliss, discovered death certificates for almost 800 infants, but no burial records at a mother and baby home in Tuam, County Galway, which was run by the Bonsecour sisters. It spurred the government into action in 2014.
I sought approval from Cabinet this morning for the formal setting up of a commission of investigation.
The following year, the commission of investigation, consisting of 3 members and led by Judge Yvonne Murphy, was established. It was tasked with investigating and reporting on what occurred in 18 institutions across the country, including Tuam. Its deadline, February 2018.
The commission have the power to investigate and compel both people and documentation. Clearly arising out of that, there might be information that could be of interest to the Gardaí.
And so the Commission got to work, calling on those who were resident in or who worked in any of the mother and baby homes or county homes subject to the investigation. Politically, the Department of Children had a new minister in charge.
I've met the Commission a couple of times now. They've identified that many, many more people have come forward to give evidence to the confidential committee, and they've made every effort to ensure that they will hear anyone who wants to come.
In 2017, the Commission announced that multiple human remains aged between 35 weeks and 3 years had been found in an underground structure in Tuam. The remains dated from the time the mother and baby home was in operation. The Commission said the structure in which they were found appeared to be a sewage tank, but it said it couldn't determine if it was ever used for that purpose. The Taoiseach at the time, Enda Kenny, gave this reaction.
No nuns broke into our homes to kidnap our children. We gave them up to what we convinced ourselves was the nuns' care. We gave them up maybe to spare them the savagery of gossip, the wink and the elbow language of delight, in which the holier-than-thous were particularly fluent.
Having been granted an extension to its deadline, the Commission published its 5th interim report in 2019. It examined burial practices in mother and baby homes. It showed 900 children had died in the Bessborough home in Cork, but just 64 burial locations were identified. The coalition of mother and baby home survivors were devastated.
What has been shocking is the fact that Bessborough Angels plot has effectively disappeared on us. We thought as a community we knew exactly where it was, and nobody knows where between 700 and 900 babies and probably more are buried.
In its 7th interim report published this year, the Commission declared that its final report would go to the Minister on October the 30th. There was also the issue of a database that it had in its possession, which it viewed as valuable.
Thank you.
And then another change of minister.
It's not my desire to act in this way.
Minister Roderick O'Gorman brought urgent legislation through the Oireachtas last week to get the database transferred to Tusla, which led to wider concerns about survivors getting access to their own information from the database and the wider archive.
The haste is motivated solely by the need to get this legislation passed by the 30th of October, which is the deadline for the Commission of Inquiry.
This caused hurt and trauma for former residents and people born in the homes who have faced innumerable obstacles in tracing their pasts, as Noel Brown explains.
I began tracing my birth family in 2002. And I've only finished my story now with no help from estate agency Tusla, unfortunately. It was a very, very long, difficult experience. So I went down the DNA route and found birth family within 6 weeks to be told that my birth father had died in 2016. So I don't know what you do with that anger and hurt, you know. The only thing I've done is turn it into activism, because I feel if there are people who can't speak out, I can. And lose the shame and the stigma, but and empower myself and do something about it. And that's why I've been fighting, and that's why all people are fighting.
Like Noel, Bláthain Hurley was born in the Bessborough mother and baby home in Cork, and she's looking for a birth cert.
I always had two documents. One, a very short cert that said basically that I was born. It also said that I was born in Dublin. And when you're from Cork, that's a bit of a bugbear, because you know you weren't. because all babies at that time who were adopted, their births were registered centrally in Dublin. And it's also been a reminder to me that I'm a second class citizen. I don't have the same rights as everybody else in this country. I can't go to an office and ask for a copy of my birth cert and somebody just ream it out and hand it over to me. That's never going to happen.
But perhaps there's a glimmer of hope. It's been confirmed that GDPR applies to the archive and the database that will arrive in the Minister's office today. And even though many more steps have yet to be taken, the country has moved closer in enabling those who are simply trying to find out about where they've come from to do so.
That report from Alva Keneally. It's coming up to 29 minutes past eight. You're listening to Morning Ireland.
AIB said third quarter trading was more resilient than expected, with tentative signs of recovery in new lending as 74% of customers on payment breaks returned to regular payments. Ulster Bank has reported an operating profit of €1 million for the 3 months to the end of September, down from €34 million at the same time last year. Ulster Bank said it had approved over 17,000 payment breaks. Amazon continues to be one of the biggest winners from the pandemic. Sales at the internet giant shot to over $96 billion in the 3 months to the end of September. Facebook reported a whopping 2.5 billion daily users on average in September across its platforms. Revenue at Facebook jumped 22%. Apple sales hit $64.7 billion, up slightly from a year ago. But shares in the firm sank in after-hours trading as investors digested a more than 20% drop in iPhone revenue. On the currencies, €1 buys 90.3 pence sterling and $1 16.8 cents.
Morning Ireland, it's 27 minutes to nine and a busy weekend of sport ahead. Here's Des Cahill.
Busy is an understatement, Donia. It's a monster of a weekend. We're going to look ahead to it all now. But first, reflect on last night and Dundalk's trip to London. No joy, though. They lost 3-0 to Arsenal in the Europa League tie. The Gunners led 2-0 at half-time. Two mistakes just before the break cost Dundalk dearly, and Nicolas Pepe scored a third after the restart. Dundalk played well overall. Tough week for them, though. They now play St Pat's and Inchicore on Sunday, and then they're away to Rapid Vienna next Thursday. Also in their group last night, Molde beat Rapid Vienna 1-0, who join Arsenal now at the top of the table on 6 points apiece. Let's hear from the Dundalk manager, Filippo Giovagnoli.
We had to suffer, we know, but I think we were decently organised defensively, actually good organised, because we didn't concede almost one shot to them until the goal that came from a corner kick, kind of rebound between our goalie and our defender. Few things went well. We try in few occasions to build up, like we prepared on possession. I think this was the plan. I think we did quite well. Of course, then the quality of this fantastic team made the difference without doubt.
Elsewhere, Celtic lost a two-goal lead but held on for a 2-2 draw with French league leaders Lille. Rangers beat Lech Poznan 1-0. Tottenham surprisingly beaten 1-0 in Belgium by Antwerp, and Leicester were 2-1 winners at AEK Athens. Now, Galway United have been handed a reprieve following an appeal over a points deduction involving Wexford in the SSE Electricity League First Division. Wexford appealed a points deduction over an illegal player, and an arbitration found in favour of Wexford, so that changes the final standings of the First Division. Cabinteely lose the points they had received and they drop out of the playoffs and replaced by Galway, who now play Bray Wanderers tomorrow in the first leg of the semi-final playoffs. But Cabinteely may seek to delay that playoff. The Tour de France green jersey winner Sam Bennett has been stripped of a second stage win in the Tour of Spain after he was found guilty of irregular sprinting. Bennett thought he'd sealed his ninth Grand Tour stage win and a second in this year's Vuelta, but Belgium's Pascal Ackermann was subsequently awarded the stage after the commissars studied footage of Bennett hitting Emil Lipin with his shoulder heading on the run to the stage finish, and Bennett was relegated to last place. Dan Martin, though, remains in third place overall. In rugby, Connacht's Pro 14 clash with Benetton on Sunday is postponed because of positive COVID tests in the Italian panel. But the big rugby story of the weekend, of course, is can Ireland clinch the Six Nations title in Paris tomorrow night when they take on France? We'll be covering it live on Saturday Sports, which is on for 8 hours from 2 to 10 o'clock. Donal Lenihan will be with Michael Corcoran for commentary on that. So what's Donal's verdict?
Yeah, look, it's historically we've only won in Paris twice since that famous Brian O'Driscoll hat-trick 20 years ago, and we've had a lot of very good sides have travelled there since. Interesting, it's a young French side. They're still vulnerable in so many ways, and I have to say I think it aids Ireland's cause that Gael Fricu has gone on to the wing, breaking up that centre partnership with Virmi Vakatawa, who've been outstanding. But look, the thing that worries me, the power of that French pack, I think this is the day that we could regret the fact that both Ian Henderson and Tadhg Furlong are missing from that Ireland front five. So I think, unfortunately, it's going to be France to shade it.
All right, Donal, thanks for that. Well, earlier we looked ahead to the Camogie and Hurling Championships. Donal Cusick predicted wins for Kilkenny and Wexford in Leinster and Cork and Limerick in Munster. This weekend, though, sees the start of the men's and women's Gaelic football championships. Tomás O'Shea will give us his verdict on the men's games. And I know the weather conditions could be very significant, but as best as you can give us your view, let's start with Munster.
Okay, Des, well, Waterford versus Limerick. Limerick won their league tie narrowly, but they're the confidence team, and after being promoted, I'm going to go with Limerick against Waterford. You have Tipperary against versus Clare. This is Division 2 versus Division 3. It's an opportunity for one of these teams to get to a Munster final. I think it'll be really, really close, but I think if Clare can hold the Tipperary forwards, I think Clare will win.
Okay, on to Connacht.
You can only see one winner between Leitrim and Mayo, Des. Leitrim have had preparations hampered with COVID, and despite being demoted to Division 2, I think Mayo are chomping at the bit. I think they have a good competition going, and I think Mayo will come through here.
Busy weekend in Leinster.
Yeah, you have Louth versus Longford. In February, Longford beat Louth by 3. Louth beat a weakened down team last weekend, but they got blown away by Cork the week before. It's a hard one to call, Des. Longford wouldn't play Cork last weekend. Added pressure on them. I'm going to go with Louth just, Des.
Okay. And moving on to the other Leinster games.
Wexford and Wicklow, Des, in tough conditions. They played a cracker last weekend, a huge win for Wicklow. However, I think there's more to learn for Wexford here, and I think if they work that little bit harder, I could see Wexford actually edge it out. And then you have Offaly versus Carlow. Carlow, unfortunately, didn't play last week because they were to play London. They finished below Limerick, Wicklow, Antrim and Wexford in the league, and I've been quietly impressed with John Mahan, the way he can organise a team. They lost narrowly to Derry. I'm going to go for Offaly there, Des.
And finally, a couple of big games in Ulster, Tomás.
Yeah, it is. Monaghan versus Cavan on Saturday. Cavan were very disappointed to go down to Division 3 last week. Results in a crazy Division 2 went against them. Story of their league days was that of creating chances but just not taking them. Narrow losses to Kildare and Roscommon makes this weekend kind of... It's a tough ask for them. It's a tough ask for Mickey Graham to lift them, because Monaghan had a resilient draw against Meath on Sunday, but they were a lot sharper than they were against Kerry. And I suppose if Monaghan improve on conceding 117 to Meath, you can't but could see Monaghan go through here. Then you go on to Derry versus Armagh. It's a very tricky one for Armagh. There's all eyes on them to progress here. No real pressure on Derry at times. Armagh still look naive. They can be in total control of a game and lose it. They've unbelievable talent. We know that. The O'Neills, Grugan, Campbell, Charlie Ogue. But Derry have been impressive this year. I saw them against Cork, and the only issue I have with them is if you're direct and composed, they struggle. And I think Armagh, if they're ready for a battle for 75 minutes, they'll win that one. The last match is the Donegal versus Tyrone. It's the match I've been waiting for all season. You know, if this championship was going to go ahead, Donegal against Tyrone, I thought it's going to be scary because one of these teams will be gone after the weekend. They played each other 2 weeks ago, and based on that alone, Donegal were better. They were just better at counter-attacking, and they also put more pressure on Tyrone into forcing mistakes. Not by much, but enough. However, Tyrone went on the front foot against Mayo, and very impressive. I thought Hart, Donnelly, McKenna, Canavan, they gave you something extra, and you're thinking, wow, if these fellas come out like this against Donegal next Sunday, it'll be a right cracker. I do think that Donegal might have that little bit much for Tyrone. It's the hardest game of the weekend to call, Des. We could have penalties, dare I say it, but I'm just going to go hesitantly for Donegal.
All right, thanks for that, Tomás. Now, the Ladies Football Championship actually gets underway tonight. There's a huge clash between local rivals Armagh and Tyrone. Tomorrow then, Tipperary play Galway, and Donegal meet the All-Ireland champions Dublin. Now, Tomás referred earlier to the influence the weather could have this weekend. So how does Dublin's Niamh Collins think they'll adapt to this strange championship with no crowd and mixed weather?
I suppose in a way, you know, when you look at things like the conditions and the pitch, like there are things you can't control, and you know, that would be one thing we'd always be very strict on. You know, you control what you can control. So I suppose it's been practicing on, you know, how are we going to get the best out of ourselves despite these conditions. So how can we play our game in the whatever way, you know, the pitch or the weather is going to throw at us. In terms of the supporters, you know, look, that's just for the best. You know, I think everyone is totally happy to play behind closed doors. Public health is, you know, the number one priority, and you know, hopefully in a year we can be back with 60,000 people in the stadium.
Hopefully so. Now then, in golf at the Bermuda Championships, Patrick Harrington is tied for sixth place. He's on 4 under par after a round of 67, and he's 4 strokes behind the leader, Peter Malnati of the US. What if it's Seamus Power finished on 2 under par? Now, we're going to talk about racing now. We've action today, Down Royal in the afternoon and Dundalk this evening. But yesterday in Clonmel, Justin, there was a lovely moment. Aileen O'Sullivan won her first race as a jockey, and she did an interview afterwards. And she works full time in the bank in AIB in Navan. But her pure raw joy at victory was incredible. This was her interview afterwards with Racing TV.
What does it feel like to ride your first winner on the track? What was the emotion going by the line?
I can't, you're going to make me emotional again. I cannot describe it. It's just like, it's a dream come true. I couldn't believe it. Like, it's just, it means the world. This is why you get up in the morning. This is why we do it. Like, I am so chuffed on him, and I can't believe the horse. He was just as good as gold. I even thought we'd another lap to go. Like, it was just, he just jumped from fence to fence, and the more I swung out of him, the more he wanted to go and fight me. Do you know what I mean? Like, he just never gave in. He was brilliant.
And you stole a peek over your left shoulder turning in. You saw Jack Kennedy looming up alongside you. What went through your mind then?
I was like, oh no. But I knew, I was like, Jesus, I better get rolling. And he rallied up that hill. My God, he just, when I needed him, he stuck his head down and he won them last two fences. My God, I didn't even have a chance to breathe between them. He was just lightning quick over them. So he's jumping, saved the day. Like, he was brilliant.
Well done, Aileen.
Hard to go back to your job in the bank after that, isn't it?
Isn't it? Yeah, well, it's great. And everyone's delighted for it. Very popular. And finally, Justin, it's a big day in sport. If you share your birthday today, it's with a couple of the greats. It's Johnny Giles is 80, I see, today. But today, very significantly, it's the 100th anniversary of the birth of hurling's greatest, Christy Ring. And I know you, from a proud Cork hurling family, it would mean a lot to, but
that's right. Once said, Des, never take your eye off the ball, even when it's in the referee's pocket. They tattoo that to everybody in Cork and Perth.
They do, of course. And Marty has a special nationwide programme about Christy Ring at 7 o'clock this evening. The Examiner, by the way, for hurling, has a superb supplement on Christy Ring. But and Donlow Cusick, who's from the native village of Christy Cloyne, he's laying a wreath and speaking after half-nine mass in Cloyne. So it's a big big, big day for hurling's greatest.
It is indeed. Des, thank you. Now, should children's clothes be considered essential items? Opposition parties have called for a common sense approach. Last night on Prime Time, speaking with Miriam O'Callaghan, Minister of State at the Department of Enterprise, Damien English said that clothes are not essential.
It's not confusing. I think we've had this discussion on numerous occasions with the retail sector. And to be clear, to try to make it fair, the difference now compared to last March is all those goods can still be purchased.
But Minister, are socks for your child essential?
Clothes are not essential.
Clothes are not essential. Well, our reporter Cillian Sherlock joins us now in studio. Cillian, what has been the reaction to this been?
There's been quite a lot of opposition to this. Earlier on the programme, the education spokesperson for the Social Democrats, Gary Gannon, said the minister let himself down, that children's clothes should be essential and that a lot of people don't have the capacity to shop online. However, the government is remaining firm on this one. In a statement to this programme, a spokesperson said that there's been no change in their policy on children's clothes and that the goal behind that was to reduce congregations of people. This morning, I was speaking to quite a few people outside the National Maternity Hospital on Holles Street in Dublin, and the vast majority of them were shocked by the minister's comments.
Yeah, I 100% believe that children's clothes are essential. You just don't know when they're going to grow out of something. I have two children myself. My youngest has just grown out of shoes, I know, and I'm in a situation where I don't quite know what I'm going to do. I suppose I'm going to try and go online, but it's not ideal. I'm not sure if she's one size or two sizes larger.
Do you think children's clothes should be essential?
100%. From toddlers to newborns, from children being in school, they'll always going to need new socks, new underwear, new jumpers. In these times, it's an absolute disgrace that you can't go into the likes of Tesco's, Dunn's, Dale's, anywhere and buy something off the shelf.
I think it's a totally absurd comment. I think particularly in the winter now, people need to be changing the wardrobe over and getting warmer clothes. And whether you're a parent buying clothes for a newborn or whether you're stocking up for older children or for yourself or for elderly people, everybody in every demographic is going to need clothes.
I do think it's going to take somebody to walk into a shop with no clothes, maybe a mask and a pair of socks, and I think it would make it realise how necessity clothes are.
And just a few days ago, a father in Wales tried just that by walking into a supermarket in his underpants after clothing was deemed non-essential. 2 days ago, though, the government there added baby clothes to the list of non-essential items.
And we're not advocating that. Cillian Sherlock, thank you very much indeed for that. And just an update on our coverage earlier that the report of the Commission into Mother and Baby Homes would be published after being reviewed by the Minister for Children, the Office of the Attorney General and other government departments. The government has said that report will not be reviewed by several other government departments prior to publication. The time is 10 to 9.
Now, families around the country will be celebrating a different Halloween this weekend. The trick-or-treating and communal bonfires may be out for this year, but we thought we'd have a look at the many ancient Irish traditions and beliefs around Halloween or Oíche Hána. And before we hear from Dr. Christopher McCarthy from the National Folklore Collection, here are a couple of clips to give you just a flavour of, if you like, the traditional Halloween. First, here's Moira Banniogán on the tradition of putting nuts in the fireplace to tell the future.
You'd have the hazelnuts and, you know, the bars of a grate, the big fires we used to have with the bars going across the grate. You know these? They were big ones with a hobbit each side. Well, you put a lot of little nuts along the bars there, you see. You call one nut, you say, that's Katie, if she was there, we'd say. Another one is Johnny's, another one is Paddy's and Lizzie's and so on along. And the first one that would blow, with the heat of the fire, you see, it would make one move and hit the others. They were supposed to get married. Mm. And that was it. They were supposed to get married. If one hit the other, one this side hit a girl at the other side and so on. They used to put them the way a man and a woman and so on like that.
The way you could tell your future for getting married. But if you were really unlucky, you could meet the ghostly Pooka. And to be safe, you had to be sure to have your sloes picked in time. All described here by Patrick Johnson from County Westmeath.
There was supposed to be a Pooka. Did anyone ever see him? Is he in the shape of a dog? or what? No, these old people said, he's in the shape of an ass, a black ass. If the poker will come behind you and he'll run his head right in under your two legs and he hates you back at him. And away he'd start. And he'd tear you through bushes and he'd tear you through the ditches. And you get all tore at him and he'd fling you up when he'd think you had enough of it.
Yeah, you wouldn't want too much of that, would you? Just a few of the lovely Halloween memories in the archives of the National Folklore Collection, and its director, Dr. Christopher McCarthy, is on the line. Good morning, Christopher McCarthy.
Good morning, Anya.
Now, Halloween, of course, it's Iha Hauna in Irish. Why was Samhain such an important time for the Irish?
Well, it's what we call one of the quarter days of the year, and it's the beginning of the of winter, effectively, the dark period of the year. So it's very, very old. There's a lot of early references to it in Irish literature. And it was a time when the dead were believed to be visible, although that's particularly associated with All Souls Day, which is November 2nd. But at this period of time, when we move from the light period of the year into the dark period of the year, there was feasting and celebrations and merrymaking to mark the occasion.
So the traditions we will, most of us, have some familiarity with, the ring and the barmbrack, children's games like bobbing for apples or coins. What's the significance of all of those?
Well, it's divination is the main idea there, foretelling the future. And it's at high points in the calendar that often divination is associated with. So people would be observing the weather very closely for signs of what the weather over the coming months would be like during the winter. So if it was very windy, for instance, on the Halloween night, that would be a sign that there would be a lot of storms and bad weather. People would look at the moon as well, and if the moon was very bright, that was a good sign for weather during the winter. But if clouds were moving across, are seen to be moving across the face of the moon, that indicated that there would be storms.
I think we've a blue moon and an awful weather forecast for the weekend, so I don't know what that signifies, Christopher.
Well, watch out tomorrow night and see what it looks like. The other part of it, Anya, is divination about what was in store for us in our lives. And this is particularly important for children. So there was a whole range of divination. The Barn Brack is a classic example of it. That's where you bake a cake with and you put a ring in it or various other items. For instance, a coin is very common. If you found the ring, you would be the first to be married in that household among the children. If you found the coin, you'd be rich, and so forth. And another nice variation of that is to put out several plates and to put clay in one, water in another, and a ring in the other, and to blindfold one of the children and then to get them to select one of the plates. Mm-hmm. If you selected the water, the plate with the water in it, that signified that you would travel abroad. It's a common theme in Ireland, of course, with emigration. If you selected the clay, that was a sign of an early death. If you selected the plate with the ring in it, that would be a sign that you'd get married. So there's a whole lot of variations mm-hmm. of this.
And there's kind of, is that, what's the origin of tricking or treating? Because in all of that, you know, you can do very well and maybe get the ring and marry the person of your dreams, or you could end up with the clay, which would be a lot more unfortunate.
Yes, trick or treating are, when I was a young lad, it was known as simply the rhyme you announced when you visited a house was, help the Halloween party, any apples or nuts. The trick or treating has, I suppose, is a when Halloween went to the States, when it was brought by Irish and indeed Scottish immigrants to the States, it became very popular there. And in the last 40, 50 years, it became known as trick-or-treating. And essentially, Anya, it's begging, going from house to house and demanding money. But it's a very inclusive thing. Everybody looks forward to seeing all of these people visiting.
Well, we wish you a very happy Iha Hauna, and thank you for sharing some of those memories with us from the National Folklore Collection. Dr. Christor McCarrig, it's 4 minutes to 9.